birthdays.
All right, folks. If I can have everyone's attention, even though there do seem to be a few people missing, let me just quickly call off the roll. Jonathan is here. Gabriella is here. Caroline is here. Nandini is here. Sabrit is not here. Rachel's here. Sotonia is not here. Yash is here. Jackie Cates is not here yet. Josh Kaiser? No?
Yes.
I meant Josh Weinstock is not here. Let's see. Ken is here. Emily is not here, at least yet. Vivian, we knew, would not be here today. Jen Morrissey is not here. Victoria is here. Josh Weinstock, no. And Larissa is here. So we will just wait to... Oh, and I have Leah, of course. You're on the new list. Yep. Thank you for reminding me. All right. So if they come in, they'll join us in progress. Let's pick up from where we left last week, when, as you will recall, we began an introduction to the negotiation process. And I won't recap everything we did last week, but you will recall that we talked about fundamental negotiation terms. We talked about the problem of anxiety in negotiation. We talked about the importance of preparation and perception in negotiation. We talked about the role of communication and the sensitivity of communication in negotiation. And we talked as well about definitions of communication and negotiation, in which we recognize the interdependency requirement for a negotiation, in that if what I am talking about bears absolutely no relation to or concern for you, the likelihood of us having to have a meaningful negotiation process is nil. Okay? And that is why, just as there being in a buyer and seller situation in a classic commercial bilateral negotiation, the buyer must be desirous of or needful of what the seller has to offer, and the seller has to be desirous of selling it for a meaningful negotiation to take place, it is almost axiomatic that in the field of healthcare, the interdependency comes about as a function of the fact that caregivers and patients are interdependent, as are caregivers upon one another, as are family members of patients and patients on one another. So having said that, I wanted to look at a couple of additional basic concepts, and the first one is the issue of the role of power in negotiation, which is often ignored in the context of some of the negotiation literature, even though it is a fundamental aspect of negotiation. So having power in negotiation is defined as the ability of a party to dictate the outcome of the negotiation. And that power can be derived from all kinds of sources. And one of those sources is possessing a greater amount of relevant information than the other party has. And lo and behold, what is it that is frequently a centerpiece of the special relationship between caregivers and patients? And that is the fact that the doctor or the other caregiver providers, caregiver and care providers, are in possession of far more information about the field of medicine and the context of the clinic than the patient, who is otherwise ordinarily a person from another planet in comparison with the caregiver who's used to residing in that environment. But also, power in negotiation stems from all kinds of alternative sources: manpower, goods, services, money, influence, rank, and title.
lots of different sources. So if in effect I am in a commercial negotiation with you, and I have in effect the ability to walk away from the table because I have so much more wherewithal than you do, that I can treat the outcome of our particular negotiation as of relatively little moment to me, then I have power in the negotiation. But there are also unusual circumstances in which apparent power or abstract power are not consistent with the question of situational power, which is also a synonym for leverage in negotiation. And what I mean by that, and let me give you, sorry, I didn't bring the clicker down. Just want to show you that situational power, or power in context, or functional power, is power that can be actually employed to effect by the party who has it in a negotiation situation. And here's the classical example of what I mean by the distinction. Donald Trump some years ago was developing a casino hotel in Atlantic City. And he had his footprint for that development, and he had his architect hired, and all the preliminary work had been done, and lo and behold, there was a little tiny corner on the left side of that footprint where they discovered, just before they were about to implement the project and build it, that a woman named Vera Wang owned this little parcel of land. Now, in the world before Donald's concept of building this huge project, that piece of land was owned by a person, to wit Vera, who had very little money, certainly had no influence or power in the world. But, strangely enough, unless Donald was going to, in effect, dump his project and move on, and have wasted all the money that was put into the preliminary phases of this, who was the one in this situation that held the leverage? The person with the apparent power and money and manpower and resources and so on, or little Vera, who in effect was in a position, because of the leverage, situational, functional power she had, to name her price? Right? So the little guy, the apparently disadvantaged player in the realm of abstract power, is not necessarily a person who is without leverage in a particular negotiation context. And that's why I'm saying that leverage can differ from abstract or theoretical power. And therefore, leverage is more relevant to negotiation than the notion of abstract power. And we're going to see a little bit later today why that constitutes a salient omission from the construct of principle bargaining that is advocated and defined in Getting to Yes. But you needn't worry about that until we talk about that later in class. Another thing I want people to be aware of, and it is relevant in a clinical setting, but somewhat differently than in other negotiation settings, that all of you know, if you think about it, that when you look at negotiation behavior, either in the real world or in the world of media, what we almost always see in negotiations is agents negotiating on behalf of clients or principals. In other words, negotiations taking place through third-party nominees, right, of the individuals who are the principals, the actual parties in interest. So where do we see that? Obviously, we see it with lawyers. We see it with literary agents. We see it with real estate agents, artists' representatives, people who just simply have a power of attorney, from somebody else. And we also see it with authorized officers and employees of corporate entities as well. Notice that in the clinical context, the ubiquity of agency is also manifest, but in a totally different way, meaning patients are frequently not in a position to be at the bargaining table in order to conduct a negotiation on their own behalf, either because they're physically or mentally incapacitated, in which case they are in reliance for their interests on a surrogate for the purposes of the negotiation. And that surrogacy can come about in two different ways. One is that there may be family members and others close to the patient who, in effect, step up to the plate and say, I want to speak for Nancy. I am the closest person to her. She is my significant other, and I believe, given the fact of her unavailability or inaccessibility, I should be the one to speak for her. Now, other people may come up and say the same thing. Son, daughter, mother, father. And in a state where there isn't a statute that actually sets forth the line of surrogates and the manner in which they are selected, meaning who has primacy, the only person who's going to be able to answer the question of who is the agent for that patient are the parties making a consensual agreement about that, or alternatively, a court making a ruling on who speaks for that patient. Fortunately, in many states now, there are statutes that literally give us the answer. They tell us that in the event that John Doe is incompetent, first, his wife will speak for him, second, his child will speak for him, third, his mother, whatever. And they differ slightly from state to state, but in fact the idea is to try to define the closest possible people and nominate them as the surrogate. But as many of you know, that is not the only way in which surrogates become employed as agents for incompetent or inaccessible patients in a negotiation, and that is because many people have advance directives. And in those advance directives, they appoint somebody to exercise decision-making authority in their absence. And that party who is named in the advance directive as the effective surrogate, assuming that the document is really signed by the person and signed by them of their own free will without duress and so forth, and whatever the formalities of the state are met, then that document will repose that authority on the individual by means of the advance directive in lieu of the surrogacy statute or a consensual dialogue or a court appointment. And then finally, you'll notice that there are going to be times in a clinical context in which, on the caregiver side, you may or may not have an institutional representative playing an agency role, in that if the hospital, for example, decides in a given situation to have its risk manager be present and to determine the acceptability of a particular outcome to the institution, then that risk manager is playing the role of an agent. And in addition, there could be somebody from the Office of Legal Counsel at the hospital who is part of a dialogue relating to the resolution of the dispute, who is speaking as the duly appointed agent or representative of the hospital itself. Now, agency is a very interesting thing and a complex thing to sort out
in the context of negotiation, simply because anybody, oh, my clicker's down there, simply because there are many, many positive additions to the negotiation situation that can be achieved by the use of an agent when, in fact, somebody seeks an agent to represent them. And usually those things are fairly obvious. For example, I go to Kenny to represent me because either I think that Ken has more experience as a negotiator than I do, and thus he may do a better job for me, because he does it all the time and he has a great deal of mastery by reputation, or in fact by my knowledge, of being a master of the process itself. But I may also turn to Kenny because I think that in a particular negotiation it's important to have a mastery of the subject matter of the negotiation, so that maybe I went to Ken because I think he knows more about the subject that's in dispute, and I would like to have his knowledge brought to bear on my behalf in the negotiation. Okay? And so all of those things are good things, and there's also greater flexibility that attaches when one chooses to use an agent, if one chooses appropriately, because guess what happens? If I'm not there and Ken is there on my behalf, I have the ability, the flexibility to say to Ken, Ken, I'm not going to tell you what my bottom line is. I really want you to negotiate this deal, come back to me at the point at which you have information for me that I can then use to make better decisions that are predicated upon this information that you got from me that cost me nothing because I didn't commit to anything. Similarly, agents in negotiation do all kinds of games, if you will, and I don't mean this pejoratively, but they do things like play good cop, bad cop. Right? Sometimes I want to look really good to the other principal, but I want to do that in a way that I let Kenny be the tough guy, allow him to present himself as being the problem, saying, in effect, maybe my client would not agree with me, but as his advisor, I'm not going to recommend that. And so I can still look like the good guy, but somebody who has a real tough-as-nails negotiator out there. And we can flip it. Kenny can be the guy who says, you know, if it were up to me, no problem. But my client is such a hard-ass, there's no way. So these are the kinds of complexities that come into play when we, in effect, put a third party in the middle, and really we're likely to be putting more than one third party, because if Kenny's in there representing me, then there's going to be somebody else at the table representing you as well. So complexity, think about what complexity means. If in fact as a result of that multiplication of parties, whether by choice or whether, as I just indicated in the context of the clinic, we now have a situation where it is more difficult to be sure that the agent and the principal are on the same page, there is a kind of a caveat or an uh-oh, meaning adding that third party adds a layer of complexity that can also lead to miscommunication and misunderstanding. So here, for example, to talk about as an associated problem of agency, sometimes there is a misalignment of incentives. And in substantive conflicts of interest, parties, the agent and the principal, can have different criteria for success. So let's just suppose that in the clinic, my person who has my proxy or is acting as my surrogate has in fact
a different notion of the meaning of an acceptable quality of life than I do. And unlike in most commercial settings or legal settings, sadly, my power of medical power of attorney, the person holding that, my surrogate, is unlikely to be able to have access to me to gain clarification. So while in non-medical situations, there are often intentionally third parties inserted in the agency role, typically unless the client says to the agent, I hereby give you full power and authority to do whatever you want. In the more common case, when there's any ambiguity or problems crop up or questions need to be asked, the agent can call the principal, go see the principal, talk about, in fact, what it would take to get them to be on the same page. If you have a patient in a coma and the dialogue about whether life support should be continued or terminated is between the person holding the medical power of attorney and a caregiver, how do we have certainty that that agent, who can't go back, nor can anyone else go back and seek verification or confirmation from the principal, that actually there really is an identity of interest and an identity of criteria in the negotiation? And similarly, although we don't usually in the clinic have to deal with a problem of methods of compensation, because think about it too, here's what happens outside the clinic in negotiation with agents. Again, I'm not picking on Ken, but he's a colleague of mine. And let's say I go to Ken and I say, Kenny, I really need you to help me negotiate this deal. Oh, I'm sure, I'm happy to help you, Ed. What's it about? And I tell him what it's about. And then we finish the conversation. And I say, and by the way, how are you going to bill me on this? So Ken says to me, well, Ed, you know, in a case like this, I really think an hourly rate basis is what's appropriate. And that's indeed not uncommon for lawyers who are acting as agents to charge an hourly rate basis. Well, guess what? When lawyers are charging on an hourly rate basis, not because they're malign people or not because they are miscreants, but just because of human nature, it is frequently perceived that the event that constitutes the negotiation event may take longer if the compensation is hourly than if it were conceived of on another basis. So let's look at some other bases. Well, Ken, how about, would you consider the possibility of taking this on a contingency fee? And perhaps we can have some criteria for what that contingency would be, meaning X percent of Y. And we would define Y, and we would define the X percent. Well, that sounds pretty good, right? Because it means that we appear to have an identity of interest, not misaligned incentives. We both want the best possible dollar outcome, because that's going to be a better result for me and a bigger fee for him. But let me throw this at you. Suppose it turned out that Kenny's law firm was having a really sort of bad quarter, and the firm needed cash flow during and or before the end of that quarter to catch up with some of its payables that it was behind on. And that somehow, as a result, an offer was made to settle the matter. And the offer was $500,000 when I was hoping for $1 million. And Ken knew that he couldn't be certain that the $500,000 was the biggest possible offer that we were going to get, nor could he be certain that we could get the million that was my stated desire. But he's feeling like, hey, wait a minute, or his partners are feeling like, gee, if we settle the $500,000 case now, we're going to get the $150,000 fee, and, you know, we really need that money now. So there is, despite the fact that there appears to be an alignment of incentives, still a potential for a conflict of interest in that regard. So I tell you this because the way that I try to convey the sensitivity of agent-principal relationships to students, particularly my Wharton students, is for them to realize how significant it is to be aware of the complexity of maximizing the alignment of incentives between the principal and agent. So let me give you an example. Suppose that it was, in fact, my desire, not just to get the $1 million, but that I said to Ken, you know, Kenny, if you can get me $500,000, well, you can get it for me in a way that the contract that you enter into on my behalf will ensure future business with that same adversary, that same client, in the event that I perform under the contract that you negotiated for me. That means more to me than the amount that I get in this particular transaction. Because quite frankly, Ken, if I can satisfy these people and I do business with them all the time, I gotta tell you, almost every new client that these people get ends up being referred to General Electric. And that is the stepping stone to where I want to go with my firm. Now, all of a sudden, we have to sort of re-articulate what it is that my objectives are and try to tie those in with Kenny's compensation system. And so what I might say is, we're going to do, or propose to him, we're going to use a low hourly rate or a flat fee, but there are going to be incentive bonuses for the achievement of certain outcomes. So if the contract contains in it a reorder in the event that I satisfy the demands or my obligations under the first contract, then he's going to get X additional. I might also say to him, you know, Ken, the real deal here is you and I really are on the same page, because if we do get referred to GE and we do business with them and our operation becomes a factor of, you know, five powers to what it is now, what I'm telling you is you're going to be representing us in negotiating all of those contracts going forward. So there are ways to try to shape the principal-agent relationship through compensation packages so that they are better aligned. Now, again, let's go back to the basics. There is a potential for misunderstandings between the principal and the agent, irrespective of any compensation package. It goes back to the communication issue that we discussed the other day. If I do a poor job of conveying to Ken what my objectives are and how I prioritize them, or I do what is likely to seem to most people like a good job, but he misperceives them, there could be a disastrous result when the actual negotiation is taking place. And finally, with respect to non-economic interest in an agency problem in the clinical setting, is you can have, in that situation that I just described, where six family members are coming forward and saying that I was the closest person to Nancy, and I want to speak for Nancy. And each of these people makes that same claim, but they have a different perception or different set of values that they're using as criteria for how they would behave on Nancy's behalf. Then you have the possibility of there being relationships between the agent and other agents that themselves result in conflict. that then has to be subjected to some kind of a process so that we can equalize and get on a page where, even if it requires a court, somebody is making the decision as to which of those sets of criteria apply. Okay? Now, I'm going to do something a little different today than I've done at this point in the course in previous semesters. I'm going to show you a piece of a commercial dispute, meaning the parties to the dispute, in their actual dialogue in which the dispute is created or acted out. And then I'm going to stop the video and I'm going to fast forward to the actual negotiation. And we will watch this commercial negotiation, and in doing so, I'm asking you to think about everything that we talked about last week and anything that you may have read in the assigned readings and possibly anything that we've talked about today, and in the back of your mind, analogizing, even though this is quite far from a clinical dispute, trying to sense in your minds where the overlaps and where the differences might be from this kind of commercial dispute to a dispute in a clinical context. So let me get the projector. We're good. I think we've got better control this week. With a little luck. Or not. VCR play. We got the VCR on.
What are we doing now in this meeting right now today? What do you think we're trying to accomplish? What do you think?
Well, I mean, all I feel you're trying to accomplish is to vent on me personally. And I think we should deal with the issues of the practicality. Like, where is Power Screen right now?
Power Screen is finished. It's a good program. Sorry, but you were wrong. Sorry, other people think it's great.
But the fact is that you've gone out, you've negotiated with these people, you've got a deal. You made a deal behind my back.
No,
I feel ripped wrong. It's not just the money, it's not just that. It's personal trust. I trusted you.
I object to the behind your back scenario because I showed it to you, I offered it to you on several occasions, and you rejected it outright, insultingly. And I didn't go out in search of a buyer for this. It fell into my lap the same way you fell into my lap because I said,
but then you made a deal. Then you
made a deal. No, I didn't make a deal. I have.
You've taken that product away from the company. I feel
this company
owns the product.
When did the company decide to do the product? When did the company okay it?
According to you, since you are the company, you went out and did it.
I did it at night.
I
did it at night.
You do lots of things at night for the company, and on weekends. If you go out fishing, Alan, I'm not saying that if you catch a fish, it belongs to the company. But what I am saying, the way you operate, if you get an idea in the middle of the night on Port Award or Resource or
Marketing, I don't 50% of it to you?
Yeah. Because it's our product. The fact is, it's our product. Are looking at it that way. It's not our product. And how dare you even say it's our product when you remember distinctly saying, no, it's a terrible product, six times to me. And even when it was Kennedy, obviously a grand product.
I never said it was a bad product. I said it was too esoteric. I didn't think it was
too esoteric.
I didn't think it was marketable. I didn't think it was, you said you put in thousands of hours. At the time, I didn't feel that that was the product in which to invest thousands of hours of development time.
You did it anyway. Yes, I did it anyway, and I'm glad I did it, and I'm glad I did it. You know, I think that you're wrong, both technically about this new product and wrong in your whole mentality towards this market. You know, I know you get upset when I call you a dentist. Right? You have a dentist mentality. Right? Your wife said that when she spit on you. It's a shot, but, you know.
They are doing for me exactly, except more emotionally and more painfully. Because when I rejected Power Screen, I didn't insult you personally, which is what you're doing now. You're rejecting my idea. And then you're saying, okay, you never contributed. You feel as if the company is entirely you. And that all I did...
You show up once a month and wring your hands and naysay and complain and kvetch and just generally act like a complete wet blanket. And I'm expected to think that you're contributing to this company?
I'm an amateur. And that's what you've been telling me now for 6 years. And I've had it. I think you're a child. You know what?
You've been
left to talk business. You've got a covenant in the contract that you cannot compete with Hazard Stuff.
Do you think you're going to be able to take that contract and make it stand up in some kind of court?
Sure. I mean, it's very, very specific. It's not that vague.
Read a sentence that's clear to me.
Okay. I will. I brought it with me.
I see you did. I'm sure you carried it around with you.
Okay. The company will employ the manager as a general manager for a period of 8 years. First of all, there's 8 years mentioned. Okay. Well, the manager is employed here under, and for 1 year after termination of such employment, the manager will not engage...
Are you going to read the whole thing to me? Cut to the part that...
I'm reading it. ...will not engage in competition with the company, either directly or indirectly, in any manner or capacity, as advisor, principal, agent, partner, officer, director, blah, 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 of any association or otherwise in any phase of the business of designing, writing, testing, selling, or producing microcomputer software.
No problem, because there's no competition with Power Screen between Border Word and Word Control
software. I mean, whether you like it or not, this is the real world. This is what judges and lawyers pay attention to. This is a legal document.
Well, go to your people, the judges and lawyers and that ilk, right? And if you're right, right, then good. But you're not going to win. You have to prove that I was negligent, and you're not going to be able to do that.
No, all I have to prove is that you signed this contract.
Okay, if it's that simple, go ahead. Why are you sweating?
Well, because I don't want to lose the company. I see something to gain in here. The other guy who says I'll take
just
my ball
do
back
something right now, quickly. I don't want to talk about this for another 6 months. Do it now. Dissolve the company. Sue me. Do whatever you're going to do. Just
all
do it now. I just don't want to
negative
continue like this.
It's
then
all negative. You're
then
totally negative. You want to come in and talk about it?
No.
Okay. Now we're going to have to see you in court.
I'm looking forward to it.
That's not your environment. They don't do things the way you like them in court. And you know something? The judge is probably a drudge, too.
All right. Now... fast forward. Okay, so we have a long fast forward before we get to the actual negotiation. so bear with me. I'm not sure how fast this machine is. They are now in the process of simply consulting with their advisors prior to the negotiation. Sorry for the long delay. Next semester, I'll put the fight on a separate tape. don't worry, the next consultation is briefer.
Company that made you go from being mad to
betrayed, whatever, I don't know what it is, but we immediately got extremely emotional.
I guess my feeling was that, we're talking company this and company that, or here with lawyers, but really what happened is I invested in you. I mean, you're the company,
mm-hmm.
in that sense, and you're the asset of the company that mm-hmm. I invested in. You're the... and you're the tangible thing, and suddenly I felt excluded, but also this asset, which is you, and power screen, suddenly gone. So I felt...
I never planned to leave the company and until we started arguing. I never fantasized leaving the company. And then when we got bitter, I did for a while, being truthful. But are we getting off the point here?
No, I think it's not harmful at all to have an understanding of the perceptions on it. My notion is to survey the perceptions and interests and then get some options on the table. I don't think we're going to reach agreement before we have a break. You know, we're no one could try and sign an agreement in a few minutes here. We're trying to structure what an answer might be.
Well, then why don't we...
Okay.
Good answer.
Okay. Okay. Excuse me. I have to try some notes here.
Sorry.
I think that you consider... You think we have a full cut... Let's not argue about whether we have a full-time contract or not. You perceive that I have a full-time contract with Acrostar. Full-time. And my perception is that I put in 1,000 hours of what I thought was my free time writing and debugging this program, and that you rejected it. Right? And then I also perceive that I took it elsewhere. And then, for what that's worth, I don't know. Do you agree with those?
Those are perceptions.
Okay. But they're different. We don't agree on any of those necessarily, right? I wouldn't agree necessarily at this stage in this negotiation that we had a full-time contract or... I'm saying not necessarily at this stage. I don't want to fight about the contract. The next stage is to write down all our possibilities and options for HackerStar and for PowerScreen. Let's go. I've got a little head start on you. We want better management.
So what does better management mean? I mean, I think we can and sort of brainstorm and get very specific.
Okay.
Yeah.
Write down what you would like in... I know some of your things that you would like within that category. So I'd like you to say them to me now.
Well, I think that it would be good to have a professional manager who would, being president of the company, who would report to you, but who would be able to do some of those screwball things, that I...
So let me put down the professional manager then.
Yeah,
right?
Who would work for you, who would report to you as president.
Okay, subservient professional manager.
It doesn't have to be subservient,
but
subordinate.
Subordinate but, professional manager.
There certainly are problems right from the way we incorporated. And we got stuck in a situation of the 50-50, the two directors. And built in, everything has to be consensus. And certainly that's something that should be changed.
Okay, I agree. Bring in three directors.
No. Not bring in three, to bring in one more director, so that we'd have a neutral director. So that means that we would have...
Let's put that down as one option, and let me put down another box, option of three more directors, as opposed to one more director. Follow me?
Yeah, I mean, that's an option. I don't know that I'd want to go along with
that. It's not your preferred option,
right.
But that's not the exercise,
Okay, yeah. The key thing, we're not a marketing company. It's a software development company.
Yeah, okay.
I think we should really lay on the table, throw open the whole issue of how much marketing we really want to do.
and
couldn't agree more.
And all this business. Yeah, I mean, maybe we should think about, you know, there are various software publishing companies. And there's a lot of stuff on the market that has been published through other companies. I mean, you know.
But let me try to analyze now, and you correct me if I'm wrong. It's, I mean, the subtext of that whole conversation is we want outside professional marketing, right, to pick up our programs and do them. And
I think
that
would be great.
Possible.
Yeah,
okay, great.
That would be great.
You don't like to sell, and I don't like to sell, essentially. Okay, great. Fabulous. We've just made some progress. Okay, so these are HackerStar options, and let's start a sheet for PowerScreen options.
Well, one option is to treat PowerScreen as separate. PowerScreen is the separate operation that Alan has developed, and in the future, you will decide on what is not to do in the future.
I think I'm being very generous by agreeing in private with Roger that arbitration is a good possibility. I'm not saying I want to go for it, I'm just saying it's a very appealing possibility that I might say fine to at the end of all this. And also, I've already offered $5.95, and that's another option. Maybe there's more. Name one if you think of one.
Well, I mean, one of the options is litigation. I can sue you.
Tell me. I mean,
well, you would have
one option. Okay, so I'll put that down. Sue Allen. For what?
Well, I mean, first of all, you breached your contract. In disregard of the board of directors, you managed poorly. You did not devote full time to the company. You engaged in competition with HackerStar through the development of PowerScreen, which was time spent.
Are these different suits, or are they all one suit? Or breach of contract?
That is all one suit, because you caused a decline in the revenue of the company. There are damages to that, and it's demonstrable within the last 2 years.
Okay, I'll wait, you're going too fast. Sue for damages due to the company's loss of
revenue, because you were involved in the development of PowerScreen.
How would this lawsuit go? You'd sue me for each of these things all in one?
Well, I don't know why you would have to wipe the suit out, but I mean, these are the things that you did, and I mean, it still doesn't cover my options.
I think you would lose your lawsuit, most probably. I think that suit to enjoin distribution of a new product the world wants, because you've got an anti-competitive agreement that they can keep us locked up. However, courts don't like that very much. I doubt they'd enjoy it.
Gives me a much
of course, it's a reaction to what he feels betrayed. It's a hostile reaction to a betrayal. I mean, it's clear that the reason we're sitting here is that they don't agree. And
let me just make 2 points. I don't want to argue the law here today. There's no point in having you pay 2 lawyers to sit together talking about the law. It's not a very attractive alternative for either of you. What would you do if you did sue?
Fight.
Why would you bring a suit? Not why in the sense of what caused it, but for what purpose?
Because I don't want him sabotaging the company. I don't want him
to sabotage it himself.
Well, in a sense, if he's going to do it, I'm going to sabotage what's left of it.
Yeah,
go down a claiming scenario. I know this well.
Well, if you filed a suit, who would buy into that company?
If he filed a suit, it would be a dissolution. He'd be
seeking dissolution. He'd be saying, let's divide whatever the assets are. We're irreconcilable differences. Sue.
Right.
Regain the assets that the argument would be.
Half of the assets, and one asset would be PowerScreen, which you'd be fighting over.
Right.
The other assets, computers, and furniture, and
the money that he owes back to the time that he spent developing the product and competition.
How would that feel?
Well, listen, you know, it doesn't feel good now. It doesn't feel good if Jeremy Gates, you know, has Alan's word. You know, and in essence, Alan leaves the company. It would feel a little better to have some money in my pocket, and this would improve my hand when the company is dissolved.
Say you file a lawsuit, the value of your 50% collapses.
Yeah, but you see, also, if Alan goes ahead on his own, what does John Gates do? The value of the company becomes hit.
No,
because the company loses its
own. Okay, I'm going
to
stop this.
No, made to other assets, and I'm still rich to the company, as far as I'm concerned. I could still continue to write programs for HackerStar and sell this one to Gates simply because he didn't want it.
Well, that's not what you told me the other day.
Well, the other day I was ad-libbing. I was.
Now, I'm stopping it here, not because obviously we've reached the point where an agreement or non-agreement has occurred as a result of this negotiation, but because I've shown you enough in order to see why it is that even this kind of negotiation, which many of you, some accepted, the law students and Ken and so forth, might feel differently, but most of you think, well, what the hell does this have to do with me? I mean, you know, who cares? And I'll tell you what it has to do with you, everything. And that is this. In negotiations, I don't care where they occur, whether in the clinic, the boardroom, or in the courthouse. At the end of the day, they are human activities. And strangely enough, human beings, in whatever sphere they operate, always pretty much want the same thing. What do you think most people want from each other when they're involved in a dispute? At the end of the day, what's fundamental? Want to be heard? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think that really is fundamental when you get right down to it. Yep.
Resolution.
Closure, resolution, something even more fundamental than those things. And those are certainly fundamental. How about respect? What do you hear these people saying? They're talking all of this boring gobbledygook, which obviously not too many of you could be are concerned about. But what did each of them say that jumped off the screen? One said, I felt rejected, and the other said, I felt excluded. That's what they said. The hacker guy, the IT guy, who sees himself as a genius, a creative genius, who is generating all of this material that's ultimately going to make this company, in his view, a zillion-dollar operation, is in effect being told by the investor, part-time owner, that you gave me an idea and I rejected it 3-4 times, at which point he, because of his own differing value system and view of the importance of what he's doing, saying, well, if you don't want it, I'm still going to run with it. I'm a genius. What I developed is great. You don't want it, so it must be mine. The other guy says, you treat me like a dentist. You treat me like an amateur, which he acknowledges he is, but the guy is fronting money for this thing. And he's basically saying, you can't treat me like that and exclude me from the operations of this company and the choices and the priorities that it makes and the way it's managed. This is my dough, dentist or no dentist. And then what happens? After Hacker sits with his negotiation consultant, who, by the way, happens to be Roger Fisher, the author of Getting BS, he comes into the room, and surprisingly, after his outburst in the discussion that led to the ultimate negotiation in this case, rethinks his behavior and in effect tenders an apology. Now, another thing that is fundamental to negotiation behavior in all spheres for people is the power of apology. Making an apology is a very potent thing if it's in fact genuine and if it's perceived by the other party as genuine. So it sets quite a different tenor for the rest of this negotiation when Hacker comes in and basically says,
gee, I behaved in a way in that meeting, because it goes like this, that last meeting that we had, I behaved in a way that wasn't really useful, and perhaps we could approach this in a different way, thereby taking some of the air out of the balloon and letting the tensions be able to, if not dissolve, to ameliorate. Following the tendering of the apology, they begin to engage in an information exchange, meaning, and remember going back to last week's class about communication and information, they're exchanging ideas about a lot of things. Some of them are feeling-based, some of them are based in concerns about management of the program, some of them harken back to the human respect issue, and they engage in a long discussion, long and boring discussion, in which they're telling you all of the things that have been on their mind that have been leading to this stalemate, this moment of ultimate tension. And in doing that, by the way, they're not only telling the other person in detail what they think, they're also venting and engaging in a process that gives them some cathartic release, because up until now, they've been feeling like they couldn't really express exactly what it is that was bothering them. And when the theory goes, and I'll show you the slides in a minute, the theory goes that, unlike the distributive bargaining model that we talked about last week, when one engages in the model that we know or the literature designates as integrative negotiation or integrative bargaining, the exchange or the free flow of information is what enables us to recognize whether and to the extent that we have compatible or identical interests. And to wit, in this situation, they are both very clear that at the end of the day, if possible, they want this joint venture to continue. They don't want to trash the company. What they want is to find ways to make the conflict go away so that the company can continue. They don't want it to dissolve, and they don't want to litigate. And dissolution and litigation are, in fact, the alternatives to resolving this negotiation in an effective way. Because if they can't reach a resolution, there is undoubtedly going to be a legal proceeding of some kind, or alternatively, they're going to reach a consensual resolution of how to dismantle the company outside the context of a lawsuit. Now, the thing that's interesting here is that when you have a negotiation that is involving people who do have an ongoing relationship or a relationship that they're trying to forge or improve going forward, those kinds of relationships are particularly suited to the application of an integrative model of negotiation. Because remember, when we discussed distributive bargaining last week, one of the notions was, as at least as I presented it with this Turkish bazaar model, that the idea is if you don't have a strong vested interest in non-transaction-based parts of this negotiation, and the most important and most common non-transaction-based component of a negotiation is the relationship interest. But if you don't have that, then it is less likely that the parties are going to spend a great deal of time and energy attempting to find out whether their dispute has integrative potential. And Josh and Caroline were there during the intensive when I think I described integrative potential. And this is the
classic description, and Jenny, I think you were there too. But the classic description in Dennett-Yes, which doesn't come from Dennett-Yes, but it's embedded in there, is I am a father of two daughters. I have the only orange that's left in the universe. I have to take that on faith. Both my daughters come to me. Both of them say, Dad, I need your orange, and I know it's the only one left in the universe. I love both my daughters equally. I wouldn't want to favor one over the other. So I'm really, really distraught, because after all, when two people come seeking the same object of which there is only a limited and defined quantity, at the end of the day, there are only a couple of things that can be done. You work out some kind of methodology, for good or for ill, of having one of them receive the subject matter of the negotiation, hopefully in a way that is not going to make me seem more concerned about one than the other, ergo we might flip a coin. Flip a coin, the winner gets the orange. Another possibility that usually happens in the real world is we cut the orange in half. But if I ask the question, why do you want the orange? And one says to me, because I had a medical consultation yesterday, and I was told that in order to avoid a fatal ending to a disease with which I've been diagnosed, I need the juice of one orange. And the other says, the same medical consultation, but I was told by the doctor, I need the peel of one orange. All of a sudden, my options are changed. No longer is it the case that I have to flip a coin or cut the orange in half. I peel the orange, give the peel to one daughter, the juice to the other, and both of their objectives are 100% satisfied. Now, I won't give you the example, but I did say to the people in the intensive the other day that, in fact, there are real-world situations that are not far-fetched that to which that model does apply. However, unlike what Fisher and Urey would have you believe, those perfectly integrative situations are relatively few and far between, meaning most complex negotiations have a degree of integrative potential, but not perfect integrative potential. So usually what happens is we find or try to find ways to satisfy as much of both parties or all of the parties' needs as we can, understanding that there are likely to be stuff remaining at the end that we still have to bargain for in a non-integrative way using some other criteria. Now, it is also the case that in addition to the fact that we are trying to determine the extent to which, as negotiators and ultimately you as mediators, have a tremendous, tremendous burden on you to try to help people who are negotiating to identify those interests so that, in fact, if possible, they can maximize joint gain, either by trading off their interests. For example, if there are two issues in the negotiation, and let's say this is, I think I gave the example the other day of a somebody is applying for a job, and I applied for the job, and one of the issues is salary, and one of the issues is vacation. Lo and behold, as the applicant, although they're only offering me 2 weeks vacation, I know that I'm trying to finish a novel that I'm almost done with. And for me, it is imperative that I have 4 weeks
a vacation so that I can go and finish this novel. Unless I am able, in the free flow of information, to express that, to see if there's a way that that need can be accommodated by the other side, given their interest and their prioritization and valuation of interest, we'll never be able to develop that possibility, right? So, again, to take another example related to the employment application, if I were to say that I wanted a certain salary, but I didn't tell you what needs that salary demand was based on, how would you possibly know that I said $100,000 because I have an obligation to make a student loan repayment each month in a minimum amount? And if you hadn't said that to me, how would I then know that I could tell you that we have, by the way, in General Electric, of where I am in charge of human resources, that we have a program in which we match dollar for dollar every payment of the student loan that's made by our newly recruited personnel? You would have been under the illusion that I couldn't pay you $100,000 when 15 of that 100 was money that you needed to divert into the student loan, and you could get that not by way of salary, but by way of the student loan repayment program we have. You see, how would I also, you moving to New York to take this job, you said I need $150,000. You moved there from, you know, South Dakota. You went and found out that to have a reasonable abode, it would cost you X thousand dollars a month in rent. And you factored that in to the computation of what your salary demand was. But nobody ever asked, nor did you volunteer again, what the components of that salary demand were based upon. Therefore, how was I to know to say, oh, by the way, you know, we have a subsidized housing program for our junior executives. And, you know, although I agree with you that you need $3,000 a month to lead a reasonable lifestyle in New York for a person, you know, of your standing or whatever, or your perceived standing, whichever it is, the bottom line is we can reduce that nut by virtue of something that we have in place. Only that free flow of information, that exchange of ideas, can lead to identifying those commonalities, if you will, that can forge a relationship going forward. Okay? So again, what we are doing after we exchange the information that leads to recognition of compatible or identical interests, to facilitate the creation of options for mutual gain, which is what I just described to you, taking into account, as they did in this negotiation, what the alternatives are in the event that you don't reach a consensual resolution. The alternatives were bad. The alternatives, you will recall from last week, are called the BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. If they don't succeed in reaching a consensual resolution, they will be litigating and or dissolving the corporation. That is to say, abandoning the faith that both of them have in the enormous financial and technological potential that this company has shown, that if it is well managed and if parties are given the respect that they require to function optimally, will stand them in good stead. So you notice that in looking at the question of options, what they did was to talk about things like, should we have an infusion of outside capital? Should we add somebody to the management team? Should we have a methodology for deciding what projects we go forward and what projects we don't go forward with? Should we have a dispute resolution mechanism going forward so that in the event of another conflict, we won't be reinventing the wheel again? And we'll already know what to do. That is to say, in a classic situation, if you have two directors of a corporation and there's a stalemate, obviously there are ways of providing the breaking of the stalemate by the entry of an opinion from an individual who both of you agree is either neutral or dependable or reliable enough that you're willing to repose that trust in. Okay? Now,
I want to now show you how everything that I've just discussed and everything in that video is going to overlap and be harmonious with what the literature says about negotiation theory and behavior. So let me again reiterate what if you were to read Lewicki et al. On integrative bargaining, the fundamental components are. Open exchange of information leads to a recognition of compatible or shared interests. After each party prioritizes and values his or her interests, leading to trade-offs that maximize joint gains. Negotiation situations may be seen to have various levels of integrative potential, ranging from none to perfect. And now, getting to yes, which again, you just saw Roger Fisher in that video, getting to yes, as I think articulated in the intensive lecture as well, is an interesting hybrid. Because, in fact, focusing on interests, not positions, asking the why question, and then using that information to invent options for mutual gain is just a restatement of integrative bargaining theory in a shorter form. And what they've done is bookended that short form definition of integrative negotiation with two other vaguely related concepts. Concept number one, separate the people from the problem. Well, we just saw a video in which it was damn difficult to separate those people from the problem, since the people were, in many respects, the problem. And using objective criteria, again, reiterating what I said the other day, that is a great prescription and piece of advice for people negotiating. However, the problem, from a pragmatic standpoint, is that people who differ and who have a strong belief in what it is that their position is when they come to the table will often have a difficult time agreeing on what objective criteria is. So that if, in fact, in a medical dispute, there is an issue about what the proper diagnosis is of patient Y, and I bring you a tome from Professor X at Harvard, and you bring me one from Professor Y at Penn, and both of them enumerate all of the elements that are associated with diagnosis X and diagnosis Y, they may differ despite the fact that they are both acknowledged to be leading authorities in the field. And to wit, if you can use objective criteria to settle the dispute, that is great. But it is a little pie in the sky to believe that 99% of the time, that's the way out of it. Because very often, the whole problem, if it isn't the people, it may be the question of defining what the criteria is in order to resolve the dispute. Now, relationships. Why are they important, and why, as I was just discussing, are they particularly applicable to a process of integrative
negotiation. Relationships alter the dynamics of a negotiation because they create trust. Now, of course, they create trust if the relationship is positive. We also know there are relationships that are horrendous that create distrust. So I'm not saying that this is goes without saying that because we know each other and have dealings historically, that they're always going to be positive. But if they are, they can create trust that facilitates that very free flow of information that we need in order to determine whether compatible interests exist so that we can create the options for mutual gain. And equally importantly, relationships necessitate balancing short and long-term gains. What do I mean by that? If I want something from you that is the subject matter of our negotiation, to wit, $100 for my widget. Here's my widget, I want $100 for it. And you say to me, gee, I really don't think that $100 is something that I can pay at this time, and I'm sorry about it because I really do want your widget. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I'd really like to make a high profit margin on this widget transaction. But if my denial of the sale to her, which she's willing to conclude at $80, is likely to result in her not doing business with me in the future, I've got to decide how to balance the relationship aspect of this with the substantive transaction-based issue of money in the negotiation. Now, many commentators define this same problem in different ways with different language. For example, my colleague Richard Schell at the Wharton School talks about negotiations that are balanced concerns situations, defined as, for Richard, balanced concern is when there is a relatively equal emphasis or concern about the subject matter of the transaction and how that's going to be resolved, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the party's the party's belief in the importance of the relationship going forward. And what that leads to, in Schell's theory, is if you have a balanced concern situation where both are important, instead of utilizing leverage or power to bring about the result that you want, right, the leverage that we talked about, you're not going to go there because in lieu of that, you can adopt a problem-solving approach to the problem in which both of you participate in that free flow of information, lending to the recognition of compatible interests, and then being able to brainstorm for mutual gain so that you have protected the long-term relationship-based element of the transaction and insulated it from being victimized by whether you got an extra 2 cents in this particular transaction. A very important concept. So, that is why relationships are particularly suited to an integrative approach to negotiation. Now, I also showed the other day, a slide in which the notion of collaboration is articulated as a term of art by an author named Barbara Gray, who describes collaboration as composed of these elements. The affected parties, in her case, she's saying numerous, but I don't believe that the parties need be numerous for a collaboration to occur, but she refers to them as the stakeholders. It means they're the people that have a concern in the outcome of the issue that's being negotiated. Each party in this collaboration has a different perspective on the problem. And they have disparate levels of information and resources. Gee, doesn't that sound like that's almost always true in medicine? Different perspectives on the problem, disparate levels of information and resources, difficult problems, often involving technological or scientific complexity. These parties are seeking to find ways of managing their differences. Notice that managing differences is different than changing the other party's view so that it is now adapted to be the same as yours, but recognizing the differences, respecting them, and not assuming that they can be altered. To arrive at consensus meaning not necessarily my first best choice, which is going to lead to a celebration by me and a dirge procession out of the room by you, but rather that this is something we can all live with under the circumstances in comparison to the alternatives, here the alternatives being lawsuit, dissolution. For resolution, and this is critical too, because it shows you not only in Gray's notion of collaboration, but that in negotiation in general, we are not only talking about resolving disputes, we're talking about creating a shared vision. And indeed, healthcare providers and their patients and their families are often confronted with, in fact, not a dispute, but the question of how to create a shared vision of diagnosis, treatment, and how those are going to be implemented going forward while maintaining a caregiver-patient relationship. And now, here's where it gets really interesting, because of the fact that we're now looking at a source that in fact deals directly with the issue, interestingly, with no recognition. I'm sure these guys never read Barbara Gray and don't know who she is. But in the book by Blackall Simpson, Green, Breaking the Cycle, all of a sudden we have five universal principles for a collaborative doctor-patient relationship. And what are these principles? Very interesting. Competence. And again, I want you to think back to the video as well. But also think about the clinic and what happens in the clinic with patients and caregivers. What they're saying is that it behooves each side of the negotiation, but particularly the caregiver to whom they're principally giving advice in this book, to acknowledge the competence of the other party. Meaning, I'm the doctor, but you're you. Or I'm the doctor, but you're Sarah's mother. I'm the doctor, but you're Regina's husband. Those roles that you play in the real world are indicative of the fact that you bring a reciprocal competence to the table that's separate from, but as important as, the technical skills and scientific skills and the desire to heal that the doctor and the other caregivers bring to the table. Connection. Though they go on to say that after you have been sure to acknowledge and respect the competencies of that patient or family member, that you have to recognize that the biggest enemy of a breakdown in the physician-patient relationship is that when a problem occurs, if you are perceived as abandoning or rejecting the patient, the problem will escalate to a much higher level, and that you are advised as the physician, therefore, to always make clear, irrespective of whether the patient is saying something that to you initially seems implausible or foolish or however you want to would be inclined to designate it, is to always remind them, I am your doctor and I am interested in your views. I'm also interested in hearing how you feel and why you feel a certain way, and I'm also going to make sure that you're not placed in a position where I'm walking out of this room and you're basically feeling like you've been cut adrift. And so, what happens there, and why did I bother to show this crazy video, is because that's exactly what they said and what happened here. And that's what happens in the clinic. The patient being rejected or excluded by the physician or other caregiver, already loaded up with a load of anxiety that we'll talk about in future weeks, that is not likely to be equal, but rather much greater than what the healthcare professional has, is very vulnerable to being cut adrift by the person that they've reposed this relational trust in as their physician. So the idea would be here for the physician or other caregiver to focus on relationships, as the alternative to abandonment, isolation, or exclusion. Working on the relationship, even if it's hard to do, even if your personality makes that difficult, even if this patient is a pain in the rear, because at the end of the day, while it is certainly your right not to treat that patient, if you're going to treat that patient, this is your job. This is just your job. You don't have to do that job, albeit in medicine. It is a hard burden for doctors with any degree of frequency to reject patients, especially in a hospital context. However, you do have that right, and there's nothing unethical about it. But if you don't elect that difficult option, then you don't have the choice of just standing there and insisting on everybody being comfortable with the old idea of you, of the physician as expert, with no burdens on your plate of having to be sure that the patient has been respected, feels included, feels that he or she is part of that physician-patient relationship and is helping to shape it going forward. Control. So Blackall, Sims, and Green say, in order to implement this, one of the most important things that you must do is to abandon the irrational notion that physicians have historically had, that they're in control. They're not. They're not in control. I mean, if you even think just about informed consent, what kind of control are they in? You can't make the patient do what they want. And even if you could make the patient do what you want, if that's the way you reacted to all of your patients and their family, what kind of a patient following do you think you would have in the modern world? Because you would be alienating such a large portion of the patients and family members that indeed you were trying to heal, treat, and so forth. Point number four, contribution. So what they're saying is the doctor must understand that when there's a patient-physician conflict, there is always a contribution to that conflict that has been made by the physician as well as the patient or the family member. Meaning, if in fact you have become angry at the patient and therefore your relationship to that patient is now very strained, the question of whether you might be seen as an ordinary human being and therefore vulnerable to the sort of futile or the futility or upset that you manifested in reaction to something a patient said to you or did to you or a family member that you took as insulting or a rejection of your expertise or the quality of the service that you were providing. The bottom line is your inappropriate response or non-optimal response to that is part of what leads you to where you are now. Had you expertly and adroitly handled the situation of the patient who, again, we have to understand, is in this situation in an alienated setting and therefore on the short end of a terrible power imbalance, there are burdens on your side of this equation for helping them to reach a greater degree of parity in the relationship. And so you have to be self-analytical in order to be candid about how did this impasse, how did this conflict come about, how might it be resolved. And ultimately, what the conclusion is that the answer or the umbrella component of all of this is that what is required is a relationship which is truly, and interestingly in light of Gray, a collaboration. Because, think about it, if you're really involved in a problem-solving relationship with your patient, you will be acknowledging their competencies in order, you would have to, in order to create a collaboration. There would be nothing to collaborate with if, in fact, you didn't respect their ability to reflect competence in the shared aspect of this collaboration. Similarly, with respect to connection, if you are collaborating with somebody, and because you become alienated, you disappear and you stop showing up for the collaboration, there can't be a collaboration unless you're there. So if you're in a high dudgeon response to what you think this outrageous statement was by the patient, and as a result, you don't bother to come back to her room for the next 3 days, thereby cutting her out of the collaboration, you got a problem there. You are inherently admitting that you don't have control of the situation if you're acknowledging that this physician-patient relationship is a collaboration, it is a shared decision-making process. It is, in fact, interdependent. It, in fact, is based on full information and disclosure. It is, in fact, based on effective communication. It is, in fact, based on a free flow of information. It is, in fact, based upon tolerating the patient's need to speak certain feelings and thoughts that may be cathartic to them. It, in fact, involves your engaging that patient in a dialogue in which your compatible or shared interests can be determined, and then with them, brainstorming to find options that both of you can feel comfortable with. So, in other words, what seemed a little far-fetched when we were looking at this video isn't far-fetched at all, because it helps you to understand that as much as those of you who are in healthcare see it as being a realm unto itself, the bottom line is, I don't care if you're a lawyer, a CEO, a doctor, a nurse, or whatever, they're all people. And they all have, we all have, needs. And those needs are more likely than not to be in the realm of and identifiable as these very basic human needs. The question of what was going to happen in HackerStar was much more a question of recreating a relationship that was floundering because of the lack of effective communication, a lack of mutual respect, and a sense of abandonment by each, of each, by the other. And what we see when we examine conflict in the clinic is very, very similar to that. So I'm hoping that this will become clearer as we go along and talk about both mediation concepts, as well as next week we'll be talking in a bit more detail about interest in negotiation in the context of our playing a game, which is going to be a negotiation, and it's going to be different than what we're going to be doing after next week. Meaning, primarily in this course, we do mediation of disputes in a clinical setting. Mediation of ethical disputes in a clinical setting. Next week, you're going to be doing a negotiation which occurs in the context of managed care. And each of you will be playing a different role in the course of trying to negotiate this managed care program. And you'll have physicians in different specialties, you'll have a nurse, you'll have the head of the hospital, the chief of medicine, and so forth. And you will be working to create a dialogue in which you are yourselves looking at both the fundamental questions of what it is that you need in a human sense to be able to participate in this consensual resolution, but also what you need in terms of the transactional components of this managed care program. Now, I'm going to give out the instructions, the general instructions and the confidential instructions in a minute. But I'm a little bit perplexed because I don't know what to do about the fact that Jackie and Emily are not here. So I think what I'm going to do, if you bear with me, I'm going to have to redesignate some of these roles. But while I'm doing that, let me... Kenneth, let me give these out and don't start to read them because I may have to shift your role. Jonathan, Gabriella, Caroline, Nandini. Now, Sabrit is not here either. Rachel. Yash. Oh, can somebody push that down? That's not here. Josh. Emily's not here. Shakara.
again, don't look at them yet. Jen? Leah? Victoria? Josh Weinstock is here. Larissa?
Bear with me, because I have to see how I can construct a set of full groups.
Is everybody supposed to, was here supposed to have a role?
Yeah. I didn't give you yours. That was because I already can substituted you, but you are going temporarily, you are in Sheena's position instead of in the position originally designated. But I have to redo these. So bear with me. No joke. I'm so great. No wine stock. Okay. That one's easy. So here's what we're going to have. Team 1 will consist of, if you have your sheet there, and this is confusing, but it has to be, Jonathan and Gabriella will both be playing Bennett in Team 1. You'll be co-playing the role. Okay? Ken, you're playing McNamara in Team 1. Yash, you're Mason in Team 1. Emily is not here, right? Okay. Jen, you're going to be Marshall in Team 1. And Leah and Victoria are going to share the Parker role in Team 1. And then in Team 3, Caroline, Rachel, Josh, and Bakara stay where they are, but Larissa moves up to join Team 3. Now, okay, so that means...
Sorry, sir, my name's supposed to be Barat, not Bakara.
Oh, that's what I thought, but then when I saw it, I thought I had it wrong. Is it A-K or A-C-K?
B-A-R-A-K-A, Baraka.
Baraka.
Yes.
Baraka. Thank you. So, this also means that Nandini will team up with Caroline in Team 3. There are only going to be two teams now, Team 1 and Team 3. I think that everyone should now have a place, yes? Is there anyone, except you, who doesn't have a place? Do you all know where you are in the roles?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now, do you want to roll?
Sure. I'd love to roll.
Okay. Then I'm going to give, you... I'm going to give you an extra... Oh, so then we'll double up. Well, but you've already got Nandini.
Right.
Yeah. All right, so then... Okay, so then why don't you double up with Josh? Josh is right there as M. Mason. Okay, and I will give you an M. Mason role right here. Now tell me your name again.
Jordan Wang, W-A-N-G.
Jordan Wang. And I'm putting you with Josh in Team 3, and you're doubling up on the Mason role. And here it is. Okay. Now, here's the deal with this game. You are encouraged between now and next week to talk to anyone in the same role as you, whether you're sharing the role or even if they're on the other team, in order simply to talk about your general approach to the role, the dynamics of the game, any other things that you want to share in preparation for the negotiation. Separate and apart from that, it's very important that you read your role sheet, both the confidential and the general, carefully so that when we're actually negotiating next week, you're able to do this without constantly going back to the sheet, And that includes trying to understand in advance how your scoring sheet works. Okay, that's very important. Understand how your score sheet works. And if you study it, it'll be self-evident. Okay. Now, when you come to the class, for those of you who I've asked to double up, if you haven't had an opportunity to speak to one another in advance of class, I'll give you a few minutes to talk so that can facilitate your ability to function in the doubled up role. Okay? And again, I apologize, but this kind of situation is going to be with us, number one, until we know the final content of the class, but also going to be with us if somebody is absent and it's a negotiation game or a mediation game. Can't help it. We have to reconfigure the groups and the teams, and that's why I'm asking everybody to try not to miss a class in which there is a game. And any questions about this? Looks like, yeah, Ken.
Sorry, who's the other person?
You are going to be with... Oh, no, you're by yourself. Oh, I'm sorry. That would be Rachel.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I'll give you my email or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And why don't all of you who have doubled up roles exchange emails? Don't you have each other's emails anyway? The whole class?
It should be on Blackboard.
It should be on Blackboard because, again, I want to encourage you, whether it's by email or by phone, to talk to people in a like role. All right? Other questions or comments about today or about this assignment for next week? And please do try to read the assigned readings in advance of doing the game because I think that will help. It will help with being meaningful and it will make the debriefing more meaningful after we finish the game. Yeah, Ken.
I have a question about agency, though. I could ask after.
No, go ahead.
Are you aware of, I mean, in the clinical context, when a family member or something like that is acting as an agent, is there any case law that actually applies laws of agency to that?
Well, yes. What I'm saying is there is both statutory and case law that No, you're right. We haven't talked about this. Let everyone should listen to it for a second. The law in general, although it always differs somewhat from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, is that in general, the surrogate is first asked to look for evidence of what the patient who is incapacitated or incompetent would have wanted. The first source of such evidence being prior statements, written or oral, by that person. In the event that there is no such evidence, the second line of inquiry is what would the patient have done as determined by oblique evidence of the value system of that patient as represented in other of their activities, statements, and so forth that might be analogous or reflect the likelihood of what the patient would have wanted to do. If none of those things are present, then what is in that iteration called the substituted judgment, meaning what I just described, if it is keyed on either the prior behavior or statements of the patient or the value system as inferred from the patient's prior behavior, you then have the best interest of the patient standard. So the line of attack by the surrogate in the event that somebody wanted to challenge this in court was, did the surrogate in fact unearth what the prior statements and behaviors of the patient were? If so, were they powerful and meaningful as a basis for doing the substituted judgment? If there were no oral or written statements, was there behavior or other evidence that suggests what their value system is that would be likely to have determined what they would have done? And if none of that exists, then it's the best interest of the patient.
And is the agent held to the same fiduciary standard that an agent would be held to in a non-clinical context?
Yes, but of course I think the problem, Ken, is it's pretty amorphous. And once you get past the evidence of intent, then just think about how it is that a surrogate invoking the best interest of the patient is going to do that, claiming to be doing it without reference to their own personal value system and claiming to be exercising the value system of the patient. I mean, the standard is there, but it's very difficult, I think, to apply it in a systematic way. But I appreciate that question. Any other questions about agency or surrogacy? Yeah?
Are most mediators, you know, in 2012 or 11, are they just usually part of the hospital team or the ethics council team? Or are there, like, appointed, you know, hired professionals to do this besides risk?
Well, you know, Yash, it's a great question, but we haven't gotten to that yet. I think it would be better if we reserve that for when we're actually talking about clinical mediation. Because you'll notice that I have, at this point, introduced the course by talking more about negotiation-related topics that are an important part of what a mediator has to be responsible for knowing. Then we're going to talk about mediation theory and practice. Then we're going to be talking about clinical mediation. And we'll address that when we get to that point. Okay? If you can wait.
I can wait.
Okay. All right, guys. Have a good week.